content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the October 19th, 2018 issue of the Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows a big wave, a big blue wave, in fact. But on the wave are two surfers. We've got Republican Elephant surfing on a red surfboard and the Democratic Donkey surfing on a blue surfboard. And they're side by side and kind of scowling at each other. The title is Whose Wave? How the Kavanaugh Battle Will Affect the Midterm Election. And we'll go right into the main stories and how they were covered. The first one is Kavanaugh squeezes onto the Supreme Court. What happened? Justice Brett Kavanaugh heard his first arguments on the Supreme Court this week after one of the most bitterly contested confirmation battles in American history. The Senate voted 50-48 to confirm Kavanaugh shortly after receiving the results of a limited FBI investigation into sexual assault allegations against him made by California research psychologist Christine Blasey Ford, who knew the judge in high school, and former Yale classmate Deborah Ramirez. Senators were allowed to review a single copy of the report inside a secure room on Capitol Hill. The results were enough to persuade undecided Republican Senators Jeff Flake of Arizona and Susan Collins of Maine to cast their vote for Kavanaugh, as well as Joe Manchin III of West Virginia, the only Democrat to vote yes. The vote, which took place amid screams of shame from protesters in the gallery, was the narrowest confirmation vote since 1881. At a swearing-in ceremony at the White House, President Trump apologized to Kavanaugh on behalf of the nation for the pain he and his family endured throughout the confirmation process. "You, sir, under historic scrutiny, were proven innocent," Trump said. Democrats, meanwhile, complained that the narrow FBI investigation ordered by the White House was too limited and rushed, with the Bureau ignoring testimony offered by several of Kavanaugh's former college classmates who said they'd witnessed him behaving belligerently after heavy drinking. "I take this office with gratitude and no bitterness," said Kavanaugh, whose confirmation cements the court's conservative majority. "I will seek to be a force for stability and unity." What the editorial said. "Justice prevailed," said the National Review. Kavanaugh's opponents never presented corroborating evidence that the judge committed sexual assault, but liberals and their allies in the media treated the accusations against him as tantamount to a conviction. Of course, Kavanaugh wasn't technically on trial, but the presumption of innocence is an integral part of our system. If the Senate had rejected Kavanaugh on such flimsy grounds, the precedent would have been disastrous. "Nevertheless, furious Democrats are already vowing revenge," said the Wall Street Journal. "If they win control of the House in November, there will be more divisive investigations and even possible impeachment of Kavanaugh. We doubt this is what most Americans want from Congress, but it is where the resistance will drive Democrats." "Kavanaugh's victory is a loss for America," said Bloomberg.com. The accusations against Kavanaugh were never thoroughly investigated. The FBI ignored potentially key witnesses and didn't even interview the judge himself because the White House did not want him to be questioned on the record. Of even greater concern, Kavanaugh irreparably undermined the court's legitimacy with his nakedly partisan defense, in which he angrily blamed the accusations against him on a conspiracy of left-wing opposition groups seeking revenge on behalf of the Clintons. How can he credibly rule on cases involving Democrats, liberal activist groups, or feminists? The toxins released by this debacle threaten to poison the court and the country for years to come. What the columnist said: conservatives have pulled off a judicial coup, said E.J. Dionne Jr. in the Washington Post. First, Republicans stole a court seat from President Barack Obama to fill it with the hard right Justice Neil Gorsuch. Then they ran through Kavanaugh's confirmation with a bare majority of senators representing just 44% of the population. Such bare-knuckled tactics mean conservatives now have a solid 5-4 majority that may endure for decades, with four of their justices appointed by presidents who lost the popular vote. When Democrats regain power, they should seriously consider expanding the size of the Supreme Court to appoint more liberal justices. If Republicans can engage in ruthless court packing to achieve ideological goals, so can Democrats. So much for those precious norms liberals claim to care so much about, said David Harsanyi in TheFederalist.com. The Senate held hearings in which both parties were able to question Kavanaugh and his accuser. Republicans even assented to additional hearings and an FBI investigation to address the leaked allegations against him, even though they were largely unsubstantiated. Then the Senate voted, and Kavanaugh got a majority of the votes. The system worked, but according to liberals, every conservative-run institution is illegitimate. Now Democrats are complaining they somehow didn't fight hard enough to defeat Kavanaugh. After the scurrilous tactics we've just witnessed, I'd hate to see what real fighting looks like. How do I explain Justice Kavanaugh to my daughter? Asked Jennifer Weiner in the New York Times. Watching wrenching testimony from Blasey Ford was tough enough, but Trump and Republicans rubbed salt in the wound by turning Kavanaugh's swearing-in ceremony into a victory lap. GOP Senator John Cornyn even tweeted a picture of a celebratory glass of champagne with the hashtag Beers for Brett. It's a sickening reminder that for many men, women's suffering is a joke. Our cultural divide has never felt wider, said David French in TheAtlantic.com. While liberals saw another privileged white man grasping for power, conservatives saw a falsely accused husband, father, and esteemed judge fighting for his family, for his very honor. This ugly fight opened wounds that won't easily heal. And we'll also read our second main story this week, titled UN Warns of a Coming Climate Catastrophe. What happened? Climate change could cause devastating food shortages and wildfires, submerged coastlines, and a mass die-off of coral reefs within two decades, unless humanity drastically cuts its fossil fuel use, a major United Nations scientific report warned this week. authored by 91 scientists from 40 countries who analyzed more than 6,000 scientific studies over 3 years. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report says that if greenhouse gas emissions continue to rise at current levels, the planet could warm by 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit over pre-industrial levels by 2040. At that level of warming, summer heat waves will get hotter and longer, intense droughts more common, and extreme rainfall events such as Hurricanes Harvey and Florence more frequent. If warming hits 3.6 degrees, twice as many crops in the tropics will perish as in a 2.7 degree hotter world. The number of people affected by water scarcity will double, and the size of global fisheries will drop by 50%. To prevent 2.7 degrees of warming, the report says, greenhouse gas emissions will have to decrease 45% from 2010 levels by 2030 and be entirely eliminated by 2050. The amount of electricity derived from coal will have to fall from nearly 40% today to as low as 1% by 2050. At the same time, renewable energy sources such as wind and solar, which currently account for 20% of energy generated, will have to rise to 67%. The report is like a deafening, piercing smoke alarm going off in the kitchen, said Eric Solheim, executive director of the UN Environment Program. We have to put out the fire. What the editorial said, we're cooked, and a lot faster than we thought, said the New York Times. The cost of our continued coal and oil habit will be measured in trillions of dollars and in sweeping societal and environmental damage, including mass migrations as people flee flooded and scorched lands. Yet our president says he's smitten with clean, beautiful coal and has reversed Obama-era policies intended to slash coal plant emissions. This is unbelievably reckless. World leaders need to be more ambitious, said Bloomberg.com. The 2015 Paris Climate Agreement, which President Trump foolishly quit last year, asks governments to keep global average temperatures from rising more than 3.6 degrees. But we now know that level of warming is too much. To keep warming below 2.7 degrees, governments must tax carbon emissions at a rate sufficient to discourage use of fossil fuels and raise demand for renewables. The longer such a levy is put off, the harder it will be to limit the damage. What the columnist said, many climate activists oppose doom and gloom rhetoric, said Emily Atkin in the NewRepublic.com. They believe that if people lack hope, there will never be action. Yet with Trump dismantling U.S. climate policy and the U.N. giving us no reason to be optimistic about humanity's survival, that logic feels increasingly diluted in practice. But hope is not the same as courage. Pessimism just might convince enough people about the urgency of climate change and encourage them to find the resolve to join the fight. Contrary to common rhetoric, said William Murray in WashingtonExaminer.com, most conservatives agree humans are making the planet warmer. What we don't accept are the transparent wealth redistribution schemes, such as carbon taxes, which the left claims are the only solution to climate change. What's truly needed is private and public investment in adaptation and resiliency projects, like seawalls, dikes, raised roadways, as well as post-carbon technologies. Collaboration and trust between conservatives and environmentalists is possible, and it would benefit us all. If the human species specializes in one thing, said Auden Schindler and Andrew Jones in the New York Times, it's taking on the impossible. The challenges are immense. we need to cut greenhouse gas emissions by 6 to 9% every year in every country for half a century. We'll have to leave coal, oil, and natural gas in the ground, depriving companies and countries of vast amounts of wealth. Solving climate change will be harder and more improbable than winning World War II. But if history is any guide, we know what happens when enough people take up a cause as practice. Cultural norms change. Saving civilization is worth the effort. Controversy of the week is titled The Midterms. Which party will get a Kavanaugh wave? Democrats just killed the blue wave, said Heather Higgins in TheHill.com. For months, the pundits and the polls have predicted major gains for Democrats in the next month's 2018 midterms, giving them control of the House of Representatives and even a shot at taking the Senate. But last week's bitter confirmation fight over Judge Brett Kavanaugh has changed everything. Before the hearings, Democrats held a 10-point lead in the so-called enthusiasm gap, the percentage of party voters who consider the midterms very important. But the Democrats' ugly, opportunistic political war to personally destroy a man with a stellar reputation has woken up Republicans. Last week, an NPR PBS NewsHour Marist poll found that the Democrats' edge in voter enthusiasm for the midterms has shrunk to only 2 points, 82% to 80%, said Margo Cleveland in USA Today. Republican women are now even more fired up to vote, 83% than their Democratic counterparts, 79%. Why? Because women don't want to see their innocent fathers, husbands, brothers, or sons subjected to the kind of shameless smear campaign that nearly ruined Kavanaugh. Their anger has unleashed a red wave that will limit Democratic gains in November. Not so fast, Republicans, said David Schoen in TheHill.com. While Republican women did rally around Kavanaugh, surveys of women as a whole showed that only 30% believed Kavanaugh's denials that as a hard-drinking teenager, he sexually assaulted Christine Blasey Ford. Democrats still hold a roughly 12-point advantage among women in the generic ballot. Even worse for Republicans, said James Arkin in Politico.com. They won last week's confirmation fight. With Kavanaugh now comfortably ensconced on the court, GOP anger will likely subside, whereas the anger of Democrats, who believe Republicans knowingly seated a perjuring abuser, will only intensify. The Republicans' Brett bounce may be real, in other words, but sustaining that momentum through Election Day won't be easy. If anyone knows how to keep Republicans angry, it's President Trump, said Peter Hamby in VanityFair.com. In tweets and in red state rallies over the past week, the mad puppet master of identity politics has broadened the Kavanaugh hearings into a dystopian nightmare in which militant left-wing mobs are out to destroy decent beer-drinking white men everywhere for something dumb they did decades ago. Liberals may roll their eyes, but it was exactly this kind of base-rousing, fear-mongering rhetoric that got Trump elected in the first place. Here in Trump country, said Gary Abernathy in WashingtonPost.com, we saw on our own TV screens that Democrats and the liberal media have adopted a presumed guilty standard for men and Republicans. For any Republican who had been thinking of sitting out the midterms, this was just what the doctor ordered. The Kavanaugh bounce is already subsiding, said Jennifer Rubin in WashingtonPost.com. A new Post poll of 69 crucial House battleground races showed a massive 19-point swing toward Democrats since 2016. A new Politico poll shows the enthusiasm gap is back to where it was before the hearings, and that by 46% to 40% Americans say the Senate should not have elevated Kavanaugh to the court. Trump, meanwhile, continues to crank up Democratic rage by mocking survivors of sexual abuse. As the Kavanaugh issue inevitably fades for Republicans, Democrats need to keep their eyes on the prize, said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post. If they can't get their voters to the polls on November 6, after the GOP's latest judicial power play, then they don't deserve to win. Time for our Good Week, Bad Week segment. Seems that it was a good week for consistency. When Chris Davis of the Oakland Athletics finished the baseball season with a .247 batting average for the fourth consecutive year, Davis is the first player in Major League history to post the exact same average to three decimal places 4 years in a row. It was a good week for Greek donkeys, which will no longer be forced to give rides to obese tourists visiting the mountainous island of Santorini. After a pressure campaign by animal rights activists, the Greek government passed a law banning donkey riders in excess of 220 pounds. And it was a good week for creative destruction. After a painting by Banksy, the elusive British graffiti artist, spontaneously shredded itself at Sotheby's in London when an anonymous bidder bought it for $1.4 million. The art world being what it is, experts say the tattered remains of Girl with Balloon are now worth more than $2 million. But it was a bad week for creative destruction as well, after artist Sid Elitab of Paterson, New Jersey, set fire to 20 of his paintings in his backyard to protest poor attendance figures at his most recent gallery show. People said they were too busy to attend, explained Elitab, so I burned my paintings. It was a bad week for new touchdown celebrations. After Pittsburgh Steelers receiver Juju Smith-Schuster lay on his back in the end zone and pantomimed giving birth to the football. The gift of life, the gift of a touchdown, Smith-Schuster later exulted on Twitter. And finally, it was a bad week for drunk flying after Gilbert, Minnesota police warned the public about drunken birds flying into windows, cars, and acting confused. The birds are eating berries that have fermented due to an early frost, police said, but should sober up within a short period of time. Our briefing page article this week is titled, the Brexit fiasco. It's been 2 years since Britain's voted to leave the EU. Why don't they have the details worked out yet? What is at stake? The results of the 2016 Brexit referendum took everyone by surprise, and nobody had really run the numbers about what leaving the EU would mean. The Leave campaign said abandoning the EU would bring a financial windfall, but it's now clear there will be large costs. The UK contributes about $10 billion more to the EU budget than it gets from the EU in public service funding, rebates, and payments to farmers, and that money will now stay home. But those savings will be swallowed up by cost related to Britain's loss of access to the EU single market. Financial firms in London and other service industries, which account for nearly 80% of British GDP, are expected to lose $47 billion a year once Brexit goes through. All told, 44% of British exports go to the EU, while just 8% of EU exports go to the UK. With the UK desperate to preserve some kind of viable access to EU markets, the EU is in a much stronger bargaining position and has so far refused to yield at all on its core demands. What are the EU's requirements? The EU has already demanded and won a pledge that Britain will pay the $51 billion it owes in EU officials' pension costs and other obligations. It is adamant that Britain cannot have unfettered access to the vast EU single market unless it adheres to all of EU's four freedoms: free movement of goods, services, capital, and people. The EU says it can't allow Britain to choose just one or two of those four commitments, lest Brexit set a precedent for other restless countries that might wish to strike down their own bespoke bargains. Most importantly, the EU has taken the side of its member state, Ireland, in insisting that the border between the Irish Republic and the UK province of Northern Ireland remain open and free for travel and trade after Brexit. Why is the Irish border a problem? Over three decades of sectarian strife known as the Troubles, the Irish Republican Army battled the British Army and pro-British paramilitaries from Northern Ireland in a guerrilla conflict that left some 3,600 dead. The border bristled with military watchtowers and checkpoints until the 1998 Good Friday Accord brought peace. Both sides fear that if border controls were to be reinstituted, tensions would resurface and lead to violence. One way to avoid a hard border is for Northern Ireland to be included in the EU Customs Union, which ensures that EU member states all charge the same import duties to non-EU countries. But that arrangement would require Northern Ireland to institute checks at its border with the rest of the UK, a requirement Britain refuses to accept. What are the British demands? Prime Minister Theresa May has consistently said Brexit means Brexit. The 52% who voted Leave were alarmed by the growing control of the EU bureaucrats over Britain, and also objected to the influx of laborers from Poland and other EU countries, whom they accused of stealing jobs from Britons. To respect the Leave vote, May says, the UK must have full control over its own immigration and regulations and not be subject to the jurisdiction of the European Court of Justice. What options remain? In a soft Brexit plan, the UK could stay in the EU Customs Union. It's unlikely, though, that May will agree to that, because it would involve accepting EU regulations and court jurisdiction and restrict Britain's ability to negotiate trade deals with other countries. The more likely outcome is some version of the hard Brexit scenario, in which the UK would establish a free trade agreement with the EU, like the one the EU has with Canada, so there would be no tariffs. The UK would set its own regulations and immigration and trade policy. The UK and EU would have to institute customs and regulatory checks at borders. To circumvent the Northern Ireland border problem, May hopes that checkpoints there can be avoided through some high-tech scanning technology yet to be invented. What will happen if there's no deal? The UK is scheduled to leave the EU on March 29th, 2019. With no trade deal in place, customs checks would have to begin on all goods crossing the British border both ways. Since the UK doesn't have the infrastructure to do that, trucks would back up for miles. This just-in-time supply chains are the just-in-time supply chains that British stores and manufacturers use would be disrupted, causing shortages of food and other goods. British financial firms would lose their right to sell their services in the EU. Companies would lay off workers. The pound would plummet. Brexit proponents say such a doomsday scenario is unjustified scaremongering. No deal is better than a bad deal, May insists. With no agreement in sight, that's acceptable to both the EU and Brexit hardliners in the UK. It increasingly looks like May's prediction will be tested less than 6 months from now. Time for a few of the best columns of the week. The first two come from the U.S. Lawrence Baum and Neil Davis from the Washington Post write, "Why Roberts May Become a Swing Vote." Democrats might find a surprising silver lining in Brett Kavanaugh's ascension to the Supreme Court, said Lawrence Baum and Neil Davis. Chief Justice John Roberts may take a couple of steps to the center in order to restrain the new conservative majority's impact. Robert is quite conservative himself, but as chief, he has a special responsibility regarding the court as an institution, and he has expressed concern that the public will come to see the justices as nakedly partisan actors making decisions on 5-4 party line votes. In the past, Roberts has sometimes moderated his conservatism to lower the partisan temperature, such as when he cast the deciding vote to uphold the Affordable Care Act in 2012. For the same reason, he is likely to steer the court's agenda away from abortion, campaign finance, and other hot-button issues for at least a year or two, and even sometimes serve as a swing vote on cases the court does take, siding with progressives. This doesn't mean Roberts will truly replace retired Justice Anthony Kennedy as a judicial moderate, but Kavanaugh's ascension to the court might not affect the court's policies as dramatically as Democrats fear. Trump's best week so far. It was a remarkable week for the Trump presidency, said Matthew Continetti. The president gave Republicans a string of victories that began with the fulfillment of one of his key campaign promises, a revising and rebranding NAFTA as the United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement, benefiting constituencies in important states such as Michigan, Wisconsin, and Minnesota. The newly released unemployment rate, 3.7%, was the lowest since 1969. Consumer confidence is high, and the manufacturing and service sectors showed continued growth. Brett Kavanaugh was confirmed to the Supreme Court, giving conservatives a 5-vote majority of originalist and textualist judges for the first time. Trump has also reoriented U.S. foreign policy to contain China, get tough on Iran, and finally put an end to the farcical Middle East peace process. Sure, his overly florid treatment of Kim Jong-un is silly, but by attempting to defuse tensions on the Korean Peninsula, Trump is actually making it easier to constrain the despot. Trump might be over the top, combative, and divisive, but he's not afraid to disrupt the status quo by using totally unorthodox means to succeed in such disparate areas of policy. Trump has confounded his critics. For Republicans, it doesn't get much better than this. And from China, we are not America's enemy. How seriously should we take the Trump administration's hysterical anti-China rhetoric? Asked the Global Times. U.S. Vice President Mike Pence slandered China in a speech at the right-wing Hudson Institute last week, accusing Beijing of all manner of sins. Pence lambasted China's trade policies and military spending, even the defense of our sovereignty in the South China Sea. He claimed that our government is persecuting the Uyghurs, a minority Muslim people in western China, and he insisted, with no evidence whatsoever, that Beijing was interfering in the U.S. midterm elections. These ridiculous allegations are a clear attempt to help President Trump get rid of Russiagate by shifting attention from Russian interference to Chinese meddling. For its own domestic political purposes, the Trump administration is setting up China as an enemy. But the complicated relationship between China and the U.S. can't be so easily defined. We are neither enemies nor friends. It's up to China, then, to be the adult in this relationship. Beijing will have to stay poised to and avoid being misled by the aggressiveness of the U.S. government. After all, the brutal and lose-lose trade war that the U.S. is conducting will inevitably hurt ordinary Americans, who in turn will punish their leaders. The U.S. won't dare push us too hard out of fear of China's countermeasures. Our last word article is titled this week, Gone But Not Deleted. When we die now, we leave a multitude of digital relics behind, said writer Luke O'Neill. Can we grieve properly for those we love when the dead remain with us? I don't remember the final conversation I had with my father. Toward the end of his life, he was hard to understand on the phone, as years of substance abuse and failing health had garbled his voice. He'd called at inopportune times from a rehab center or hospital on Cape Cod, or the home of a friend in Florida he had somehow charmed his way into, and I'd hurry to get off the phone. Sometimes I'd find myself annoyed by his attempts to reconnect and let the call go to voicemail. It had been more than 15 years since we'd had anything resembling a normal relationship, and more than 30 since he and my mother had. Even in my frustration, though, it was hard not to think of his looming existential decline. I may never get the chance to talk to him again, I'd say to myself. I always did. Until, of course, I didn't. On good days, he'd tell me about his latest living situation, calling from a flip phone with a number that changed as frequently as a drug dealer's. He'd ask about my writing and where I'd traveled to lately, seemingly in awe of all the opportunities I had that he didn't. Even approaching 40, I'd revert to the role of a young boy eager to make his father proud, despite having received plenty of love from my mother and stepmother. stepdad. He'd lobby me to put in a good word with my sisters on his behalf, a message I would relay. Just call the old bastard back, I'd tell them. You'll regret it someday if you don't. I do, however, remember the exact day and time of our final few text exchanges, because they're still on my phone, where, for at least as long as the cloud exists and I stay current on my bill, they'll live forever. There's a photo I sent him from December 2015, just after I'd had a chance to interview Tom Brady. What Massachusetts dad wouldn't want to see that? It kind of breaks my heart to read his reply again now. I'm so proud of you, my son. I can't wait to show everyone tomorrow. I can't express my joy. Dad, go get the big fish, son. Again, I'm too proud for words. Love you, Dad. Reading other texts from around that time makes me laugh. I feel like such a logo, Oglethorpe, he wrote. I still have no idea what he was talking about. And then in February 2016, the last message I'd ever receive, hello, my son. How you doing today? I have been in the hospital for 2 weeks, but now I'm getting better. Talk to you soon, love, Dad. 3 months later, he died of sepsis. I was thinking about those texts during a family dinner at my mother's not long after my father's death. Someone had asked about a wall of photos that functions as an ad hoc memorial to assorted ancestors on my mother's and stepfather's sides, all mustached, bonneted, and stoic. The wall of the dead, we joked, but it occurred to me that the pictures are different from my father's text messages, as are the letters I have stashed away from my beloved grandmother, stuffed with newspaper clippings she thought I'd like and uncashed $5 checks for pizza. My wife just found one in which my grandmother tried to persuade her to get me to give up on writing and find a real job. Those artifacts are moments frozen in time, part of my distant past. Our phones, on the other hand, are tools we live with every day. I could respond to my dead father's final text right now, adding to the running conversation. Our devices are where we carry out the business of living our lives and are increasingly our primary means of communicating with the people in them. Should they also be where we lug around our memories of our deceased? More to the point, do the digital ghosts the dead leave behind make it harder to let them go at all? The idea that the dead can speak to us feels like something from a horror or sci-fi movie. Yet the reverse, talking to them from here and now, whether through prayer, quiet reflection, or even speaking out loud, you'd love this, wouldn't you, Ma? Doesn't seem strange at all. Keeping our loved ones stored in our smartphones, often not deleting their contacts for a long time after they're gone, has made this even easier to do. We ask our devices for directions home, to bring us food, to broadcast our entire selves to the world. Now there are also boxes we carry around that store our conversations with ghosts. Shortly before Celine Anger, a copywriter from Cambridge, Massachusetts, lost her mother, she received a voice message of her mom singing Happy Birthday. It was before she knew how bad her mother's cancer was, and now, 3 years later, the song serves as a time capsule of happier days. Angela listens to the recording on her cell on her birthday every year. She's even backed it up just in case she loses the phone or something unexpected happens. I cherish that voicemail and a few other random ones I have not deleted yet. Even the super boring stuff like, I'm running late, be there soon, she says. It's a great comfort to still hear her voice, more so on the day she brought me into this world. When we spoke, Andrew's father was dying of cancer and she was preparing his digital memorial, saving everything. On my birthday, she says, I asked him to leave me a voicemail singing happy birthday to me, so I'd have his too. He mistimed the recording, and all that's there is to you, followed by a minute of silence. He since passed away. Lindsay Mason, administrative assistant for adults with disabilities who lives in Kingston, Mass., lost a close friend in 2011 and saved his contact in her phone for 4 years. For the first year and a half, she regularly dialed the number, telling me that the saddest part was calling and not hearing his voicemail anymore, but a disconnected line. I left one message for him after he passed. I just wanted to hear his voice and get some reassurance. He wasn't really gone. By some estimates, 8,000 to 10,000 Facebook users die every day. What survives is a trove of digital footprints, including posts, messages, and pictures. So where does it all go? Turns out you can name an account executor, presumably a close friend or family member, to come in and tidy up your social media belongings in the event of your death, although that person will not be given access to your private chat logs. Immediate family members can also select the option to memorialize the account, turning off certain features such as birthday reminders, which many users report are exceptionally painful to see. Gmail, meanwhile, has a tool called the Inactive Account Manager that lets you tell Google what to do with your account after you have stopped using it for a certain amount of time. Before the deadline, Google will reach out to see if you're still there, checking your digital vital signs. If you don't respond, it will contact your pre-selected trusted contacts with the message you've written. Hey man, I'm dead, LOL. Don't look at my nudes, please, or something to that effect. And Twitter has the option to remove the account of a deceased family member, but only if you submit official proof of death. Not exactly a breezy ask when you're grieving. Which brings me to my next point. As technology advances, it promises to change the very nature of how we mourn our loved ones. In Wired last year, for instance, writer James Vlahos documented his final few months with his father, during which he tried to capture the idiosyncrasies of his dad's voice and upload it into an artificial intelligence chat software he called the Dadbot. It was an attempt to affect a sort of immortality, a concept many are working on around the world, and one sure to be improved upon. One company recently made headlines by promising to preserve your brain and upload it to the cloud. A cool idea, except they'd have to kill you to do it. For the forward thinkers among us, there are options to plan our communiques from the other side. Moran Zur, the founder of a service called Safe Beyond, explained to me that his emotional life insurance policy was inspired by the deaths of his wife and father. His wife had been suffering from cancer for years, and he wanted her to leave behind messages for their children that they could receive at various milestones in their lives as they got older. These are future conversations they will never have the chance to have. But now, even if it's going to be one-sided, she's recorded them for them in advance, he said. It's not just leaving money behind, it's leaving words of wisdom, being there for them at significant moments of their life. Being able to hear from their mother will likely be a salve to their children, but it's worth asking, how can we ever move on in this brave new digital era if the dead are never truly gone? It's been a couple of months now since I first reopened the texts from my father, and I've been looking at them again, swimming in the absurd melancholy of it. I could do the same with others who've died, but it would take an extra step, rummaging around in an old photo albums, digging through the letter boxes in the back of the closet. Now, in the time it takes to look up a movie schedule or restaurant menu, I can call up the history of my relationship with my dad. Our digital mourning isn't nearly as separated from our everyday lives as the experience of visiting a graveyard or holding a physical letter or photo. Such a ritual is an act that has space and takes its time, says Elsa Rossingstam, a clinical psychologist at McLean Hospital outside Boston. That has been part of our human lives for many, many years. The ease with which we can access memories of lost loved ones on our phones or social media accounts, on the other hand, may end up trapping us in our grief. I suspect that when it is studied, we'll find that phones have vastly complicated and perhaps even forestalled our ability to grieve in a natural fashion. Even after all of these interviews about the hours I've spent thinking about my father's texts, it's not entirely clear what they mean to me, or if they even mean anything at all. Contending with the digital endpoint of a relationship with a person who is a constant and loving part of your life for a long time is a lot different from when it is a reminder of someone who is absent. I could no longer call my father on the phone, but that was true for most of my life anyway. Perhaps I should have done so more often. Perhaps he should have. Every text I have now is a reminder that neither of us bothered to. I feel guilty about that. In part, that's because he had the foresight to die before my loving stepfather, hogging all of my good my dad died writing before the man who actually raised me could get the chance. I wonder if he was capable of thinking about any of this stuff in the last week or two he spent in a medically induced coma at the hospital as his children and exes reemerged to say goodbye one final time. It was like a dress rehearsal. We were talking to him, but he couldn't talk back. I guess I'm doing the same thing now. Although we still cannot speak directly to the dead, these days they can call back out to us. And what they say, whether it's in a voicemail, a text, or a tweet, is the most important message any of us will ever be able to convey. I was here. I am gone now. But I was here. I just went back and looked at one of my last text messages to my father, sent shortly before he stopped responding. "Hi, Dad. Was planning on calling you soon," I wrote. "Glad to hear you're well." I wonder how long he saved that one for me. Probably right up to the end. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in Boston Magazine. Turn to the talking points page now. We have an article here titled "Academia: A Hoax Exposes, Quote, Grievance Studies." Three academics have pulled off a prank that is alternately hilarious, appalling, and disturbing, said Charles Sykes in WeeklyStandard.com, taking aim at what they called grievance studies. The trio produced 20 shoddy, absurd, unethical papers loaded with incoherent postmodern gibberish, seven of which were published in respectable academic journals. Among the most outrageous papers included a thesis claiming astronomy is a patriarchal construct that should be replaced by feminist astrology, another arguing dog parks are rape condoning spaces, and still another that demanded that males who masturbate while thinking about a woman must first obtain her consent. Their crowning achievement was getting a journal to publish a chapter from Mein Kampf that substituted feminist buzzwords for Hitler's anti-Semitic rants. "College students are our country's future," said Sumantra Maitra in TheFederalist.com, "yet they are being shaped and brainwashed by ideological dogma no less absurd than this faked scholarship. Is this what parents are paying for?" The hoaxers found some real weaknesses in academic scholarship, said Daniel Dresner in WashingtonPost.com, "but the brush they use to dismiss the humanities is way too broad. Not all grievance studies are absurd, and neither is the belief that that there are power dynamics between people dictated by gender or sexual identification and race. Still, said Kevin Drum in MotherJones.com, liberals and academics should not defensively dismiss what this hoax has revealed about this field. The three authors, all self-described liberals, had no formal background in the subjects, but taught themselves how to produce ridiculous, jargon-filled papers that were greeted with praise by blindly receptive academic reviewers. Not all fields of academia would publish such nonsense, said Yasha Monk in TheAtlantic.com. All of the papers the hoaxers submitted to mainstream sociology journals were rejected, but the findings were disturbing nonetheless. One of the fake papers suggested professors should enact experiential reparations, such as chaining white students to the classroom floor to redress their privilege and demanding they remain silent. Really? If we're serious about remedying discrimination, racism, and sexism, then we have to admit that some academic emperors, the ones who supposedly have the most to say about these crucial topics, have no clothes. And we'll read some of the shorter notes. The average cost of employer health coverage offered to workers rose to nearly $20,000 for a family plan this year, with annual premiums increasing by 5%, according to the nonprofit Kaiser Family Foundation. Once again, employers also increased the deductibles that workers pay in order to keep premiums from rising even further. Over the past 6 years, at least 259 people around the world have died while taking selfies, according to researchers at the All India Institute of Medical Sciences. Drowning was the leading cause of selfie-related deaths, followed by incidents involving transportation, such as taking a selfie in front of an oncoming train and falling from cliffs, waterfalls, and buildings. Only one in three Americans was able to pass the multiple choice test required for immigrants applying to become citizens. When quizzed, only 13% of Americans knew when the Constitution was ratified. 60% didn't know which countries the United States fought in World War II. And 57% couldn't say how many justices are on the Supreme Court. And we'll finish up with a rather long quote from poet Carl Sandburg, quoted in redstate.com. It goes like this. If the facts are against you, argue the law. If the law is against you, argue the facts. If the law and the facts are against you, pound the table and yell like hell. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the week. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138, 919-832-5138.